quality is hard. I think like one of the issues that we have with the idea of quality content is understand that quality is a very ethereal concept. So it's hard to really like pinpoint, but I'll say that usually in my mind, the way I break down what is quality tends to align with nuance. If the take is nuanced, it's probably quality. And nuance obviously is all dependent upon, again, the intent. The layers of nuance are just going to be different. If I'm answering, what is a cell phone and how do I prevent having a heart attack? But there should always be a layer of nuance to it. If I'm answering, what is a cell phone? I should have in mind that there might be this person reading it and there might be that person reading it. And this person's going to need that aspect answered and the other person is going to need this aspect answered. It might be things about price. It might be things about like level of sophistication in the product, whatever it might be. There's always going to be multiple people reading it. And if you have those multiple people in mind, you're going to create something that deals with answering for multiple people, which means you're going to have some level of nuance. If you're just writing crappy SEO content where you're not actually thinking about people, you're not going to have any nuance. You're thinking, all right, to rank for this keyword, I need to say this. And there's generally no nuance on that. And that generally produces crap content.
Hi, and welcome to the Optimize Podcast. My name is Nate Matherson, and I'm your host. On this weekly podcast, we sit down with some of the smartest minds in content marketing and SEO. Our goal is to give you perspective and insights on what's moving the needle in organic search. Today, I'm thrilled to sit down with Morty Oberstein, head of SEO brand at Wix. The last few weeks have been a little crazy for us SEOs, and on this week's episode, we chat algorithm updates, spam, EEAT, and so much more. And this week's episode is brought to you by a newly launched company. That would be Positional. Positional just launched on March 26th. You might have seen it. I hope you did. And if you're one of the users who signed up, thank you so much for giving us a shot. We've been working on Positional for the last year. We've built a lot. We've got tools for keyword research, internal linking, content analytics, journey analysis, social media, and so much more. I've really tried to build the toolset that I've wanted as a content marketer over the last 10 years of building large content and SEO channels. We'd love for you to check it out at positional.com. Morty, thank you so much for coming on the Optimize Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The first question I ask all of our guests is, how did you get into the world of content marketing and SEO?
I was left in front of a SEO firehouse as a child.
Tell me more about that experience.
It was horrifying. No, I used to be a teacher. Before that, I was a CEO of a property management company. This is like my third life. And I was working for an educational software company, writing pedagogical material of all sorts. And I was one of the only native English speakers at the company. And they said, hey, we want to create a blog because you write content. And we want to redo the landing pages. Can you write content? I'm like, I can write anything. As long as it's like, you know, quality content. I can't write crap. But if you want me to write something good, I can write that. They said, yeah, we want you to write it because we don't have anybody else. So you're going to have to write it. And they said they wanted to get organic traffic. And I said, that's great. What's that? And that's how I got into SEO.
Well, we're going to talk quality content. We're also going to talk crap on this week's episode. So I do want to double click on that in just one second. But first, I know that you're the head of SEO brand at Wix. And that's not a job title that I see that often. What does a head of SEO brand do, and what do you do in your role at Wix?
So, yeah, it's a really weird like title. I made it up. That's why no one else, I just completely made it up. Basically, Wix has done an incredible amount of product development over the last 4 years around SEO. And a long time ago at this point, Wix had a bad reputation for SEO. And what happened was they started doing all this dev, but no one realized what was going on. So they brought me on way back to sort of, you know, be an advocate, like the John Mueller of Wix. And I don't want to compare myself to John. He's way better human being than I am. And that role sort of morphed over time into all of the positioning that Wix did. Now that we've kind of tackled, you know, the SEO perception at this point, folks think that Wix is great for SEO. So mission accomplished. But there's still a lot more that goes into it inside of, you know, pure advocacy around SEO and Wix. It's How do we position ourselves for the various demographics that use Wix from an SEO point of view? And that could be a site, a business owner, that could be a site manager, that could be, you know, a SEO professional, which is itself segmented into, are you a consultant? Are you a freelancer? Are you an enterprise? Are you an agency? How do we position Wix for those people around SEO? And a lot of it has to do with SEO education. So how do we educate our current users, our potential users around A, what is SEO, how to do SEO, which is multifaceted depending upon who you are, and what does Wix do for you as an SEO or as a professional looking to capitalize on SEO? So for example, we created the SEO Learning Hub, which talks to basically everybody about how to do SEO. So it could be, you know, the fundamentals on, you know, how to run a site audit, or, you know, thought leadership around, like, where's the future of SEO and content marketing colliding? Anything and everything messaging and positioning around SEO is kind of what I do.
So it's some sense a marketing role, and in other ways, a product role.
A little bit of everything, yeah. It's a little bit of an SEO role. Like, we have this whole hub that we're managing. It's a little bit of product marketing. It's less on the product marketing than it used to be. Although obviously that's like still the core of everything is the product, and a lot of brand marketing.
For any of our listeners who are not already following Morty on Twitter and LinkedIn, you should be. And we'll include a couple links to his social profiles in the show notes, because you do put out such great content.
Oh, thanks, man.
You know, nothing against John, but he often doesn't say very much, whereas I do like how tactical and specific you'll get. And also, you're not afraid of some hot takes too. So hopefully there will be a few of those on this week's episode. And I want to start things off hot. The last couple of weeks have been really volatile in search. Like, we've had the March core update, we've had the spam updates. And on LinkedIn, you recently wrote that these algorithm updates have some real teeth, and that you're noticing some sharp, broad ranking changes. Tell us, Morty, what is going on?
So whenever, inevitably, if there's a core algorithm update, there's always going to be movement, and you'll see Lily Ray post about it and Glenn Gabe talk about that. So the fact that it has teeth, meaning the fact that you're seeing sites move, that's totally typical. But when I dive into it, I have like a secret sauce SEMrush dashboard that I have because I consult for SEMrush. So I have like access to this super cool thing they built for me. And inevitably, when there's an algorithm update, I'll run through that. And it's really granular. Really, it's like super painstakingly annoying to run through all of it. And sometimes finding volatility is harder than it often is. And I'm thinking back to, like, maybe it was like the August 2023 core update. I don't remember what it was. Like, you know, that one was like, okay, like there was movement in there, but it was much harder to find than you would typically think. Or it was less hard, but not like super easy to find. In this one, like 5 seconds, I'm like, all right, there's volatility. There's way more noticeable movement. When I say noticeable movement, I don't mean like if you look at like the SEMrush sensor, one of these algorithm trackers, like you might see like it looks like relatively normal or relatively normal for an algorithm update. It's way easier to spot like the drasticness of the spikes or of the losses. Like, an update can be great for you. It could be terrible for you. It's just way more prevalent. It's way easier to find. And that's a little bit anecdotal. I don't have like a percentage of easiness.
Yeah.
I don't have a score. But as someone who's been looking at this kind of stuff for the better part of, I don't know, like 10 years at this point, I'm telling you, like, my take on this is it's way easier to spot those drastic spikes.
As far as spikes and drops go, are you seeing any patterns? Is there anything anecdotally that you can point to just yet?
Not yet. I'll say like it's a little bit surprising in the sense that I've been mainly focused on the health and the finance. Those are like my go-tos because they're YMYL, whatever.
Yeah.
You have big sites seeing drops. Allstate saw a drop and a couple of really interesting keywords. I think as a domain, they saw a bit of a drop. The Mayo Clinic also saw a drop, which is super weird because the Mayo Clinic is super authoritative and it's supposedly going to take 4 or 5 weeks to roll out. So it means nothing to me at this point.
Yeah, you know, Google was clear that it's going to take a minute for this all to roll out and hit the SERPs. And I agree. I always like to look at the Your Money, Your Life category sites first. In particular, finance. That's my favorite one. Looking at like the very small finance sites, the medium size and the large, because at least in finance, and I'm sure the same is with health, I just don't spend that much time looking at health. There are kind of clear buckets in terms of types of sites. But yeah, I agree with you. It's been hard so far to get like a clear indication of what's happening. But By the time this episode's released, it might be a whole different picture.
Or not. We could still be completely confused.
As part of the recent algorithm updates and changes that have happened in March, Google announced new spam updates and additional guidelines. And, you know, Google said that these spam updates are bigger than just AI-generated content. Like, they did clarify to say that, like, yes, AI-generated content could be a mechanism for spam, but there also could just be low-quality content being produced by humans that is spam. And so my question to you is, do you think these spam updates are largely targeted at websites using AI-generated content, or it actually is broader than that?
Yeah, it's definitely broader than that. You know, it almost feels like Google's listening to the SEO chatter. For example, like they're going after parasite SEO, which SEOs have been complaining about for a long, long time. But in the more recent months, it's been much more complaints on, you know, X or whatever about parasite SEO than usual. And I think Google took notice because they're going after parasite SEO. The crap on the web is way broader than AI. Like, if you want to look at the crap on the web, just go into the affiliate space and then tell them that they're writing crap and watch them all freak out.
SEOs love to complain on Twitter, and they also love to freak out. And we had Charles Float on a few weeks back where we did talk about parasite SEO. And like, he mentioned that like parasite SEO has always been a thing. It'll always be a thing. It's just the platforms will change and you need to stay ahead of the curve in terms of like what types of sites you can be doing parasite SEO on. I thought something that was really interesting though, like Google, I think I read that they've given publishers like a 60-day heads up to actually go and implement changes on their website. And Charles and I joked like, you know, SFGate, for example, I would see them ranking for basically every single affiliate keyword with what was like a parasite SEO article about, you know, best online slot machines. If you're a publisher and you've got a lot of parasite SEO content on your site, is that just the thing to do right now, is just to go and delete it all?
I think the wider question is like the health of the ecosystem for publishers. Like, why would Rolling Stone want to write about like the best fridges of 2024 when they could be writing about the best Bob Dylan songs of 1964? I think, by the way, they should combine the two and do the best fridges of 1964 to, you know, sort of like capture their real essence. It's because publishers are freaking out. They're dying. They need a source of revenue. They don't have a source of revenue. They haven't really figured out how to capitalize on the digital space in the same way as they have, you know, let's say actual magazines or actual newspapers, physical newspapers. And they're struggling to figure out where they're going to get sources of revenue. So, okay, I'll host your content on my website. I mean, look at CBS News, okay? You think CBS News really wants to have what is like Outbrain or Taboola articles, like the bottom like 40 scrolls of their articles? Probably not, but they do it because they have to. And that's the next thing that's going to happen. Like, Google's going to say like, you're hosting all of this like, you know, crap articles at the bottom of your actual articles. We're going to hit that at some point or another. And then they're going to be out of that money too. And I don't know what the ecosystem is going to be for publishers. I don't know how they handle this. I have no clue.
I always get asked by our customers after an algorithm update, like, what do I do? Especially if they've been negatively impacted by one. And so I'm going to like pose that question to you. Like, what do you do after an algorithm update if you're a website owner that's maybe been negatively impacted?
I'll quote Glenn Gabe on this one. Throw the kitchen sink at it, because you don't really know what the real issue is. And it's partly because it's an overall issue. It's an overall quality issue, right? You know, their SEOs will argue about this and like they're till the blue in the face. Well, maybe it's a technical issue, blah, blah, blah. Yet you could have a technical issue causing these problems, but fundamentally Google's guidance is all about the quality of the content on the website and the quality of the user experience on the website. And that's always a hard question to analyze or a hard question to fix. Like, how do you fix quality? It's usually not one thing. You usually have a quality problem because you have a mindset problem. And if you have a mindset problem, that's going to manifest itself in 4,000 different ways. So the real thing to do is fix the mindset. And that mindset, by the way, might not be because you're a spammer or you're low quality. It might be because you're a publisher trying to figure out, how do I keep revenue up? How do I keep my job? I feel like, wow, that is stupid. Like, you're absolutely killing your brand writing about best microwaves. But I also feel bad for them because they're at a point in their web life where they have to write about best microwaves and not best Billy Joel songs, which would be a hard article to write because there's so many good Billy Joel songs. So what do you do? How do you fix that? Like, if it's a mindset issue, That's like almost like you need to go to a SEO therapist or to a content therapist to like figure out like what are your issues. You have like daddy issues or something. If you're doing it because like you're just basically pimping out your website, well, then how do you solve the revenue issue? Like, I don't have a mindset problem. I know the right thing to do. I just can't do it because my bank account can't handle it.
Would you say that Forbes is as bad as Rolling Stone?
Worse?
Why?
I'm not trying to crap on the people working at Forbes. They are probably really great content writers and great SEOs and great marketers or whatever. But they have a certain business model. In order to keep their jobs, they need to keep that business model going. And look what Google says about it. Yeah, we don't look at links from Forbes. Like, we just like discount them, or Entrepreneur. We just discount them. Like, that kind of tells you everything you need to know about Forbes. Is Google saying we're discounting links from Rolling Stone at this point? No. So which is worse?
You know, to play devil's advocate, maybe Rolling Stone shouldn't exist anymore.
Yeah, no, they shouldn't. That's the problem. Like, none of these places should exist. But like, I'm not advocating that people lose their jobs and go out of business.
Right.
But if you're asking like fundamentally as a concept, like if you can't hack it talking about Bob Dylan or Beyonce, then maybe you just have like, you shouldn't be what you are.
Yeah. And to your point, like, there's definitely a business to be built talking about Beyonce. So it fundamentally, maybe they're just doing something else wrong.
That's probably, yeah. That I would say in like a publication like Rolling Stone, like something's just not healthy there.
Yeah.
Enough is going on in the music ecosystem where you should be able to, I mean, look at SCJ. And no offense to SCJ. Like, you go to SCJ, there's a lot of ads there. They're making money. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but they're doing what they have to do. You kind of have to respect that to a certain extent. Or Search Engine Land, same thing. You go to Search Engine Land, there's a big ass banner for SEMrush. When you go to, I know, because Wix took one of those out. We've used them. They're great. You get a lot of clicks out of them. And maybe it's not the greatest thing for your brand, because you go to Search Engine Land, you go to SEJ, and like, all right, is this, I don't know, is it SEL, is it SEJ, or is it SEMrush? Which website did I land on? But at least they're figuring out a way to stay alive and make money and produce content without having to pivot to talk about like best fridges of 2024. So I kind of feel like if there's a market for advertisements for Search Engine Land or Search Engine Journal, then there's definitely a market for display ads for Beyonce content.
I want to talk about helpful content. I know earlier on this podcast, you mentioned that you produce great content, not awful content.
I try. I don't always succeed, but I try.
What's the difference? What is like a great piece of content, and what is just like a really crappy piece of content?
Can I default to it depends, but explain why?
Yes, let's do it.
It depends on the audience, right? What good content is depends on the audience. If I'm writing an article that answers a very short question, when I say short, I don't mean like the length of the question. I mean like how long it would take to answer that. Writing 20,000 words to answer what is a cell phone would be ridiculous. That wouldn't be good content. That'd be annoying content. So it kind of does depend. And quality is hard. I think like one of the issues that we have with the idea of quality content is understand that quality is a very ethereal concept. There are concepts that are easy to define or easier to define, and there are concepts that are just harder to define. Like if I asked you to define, what is the concept of importance? Define what it means to be important, to have importance. Like you started to get into like the layers of existence. It's very existential. Quality is one of those kind of things. So it's hard to really like pinpoint, but I'll say that usually in my mind, the way I break down what is quality tends to align with nuance. If the take is nuanced, it's probably quality. And nuance obviously is all dependent upon, again, the intent. If I'm answering what is a cell phone, the level of nuance I should offer is going to differ to, I know, something like how do I prevent having a heart attack? The layers of nuance are just going to be different. But there should always be a layer of nuance to it. If I'm answering, I don't know, what is a cell phone, I should have in mind that there might be this person reading it and there might be that person reading it. And this person's going to need that aspect answered, and the other person is going to need this aspect answered. It might be things about price. It might be things about like level of sophistication in the product, whatever it might be. There's always going to be multiple people reading it. And if you have those multiple people in mind, you're going to create something that deals with answering for multiple people, which means you're going to have some level of nuance. If you're just writing crappy SEO content where you're not actually thinking about people, you're not going to have any nuance. You're thinking, all right, to rank for this keyword, I need to say this. And there's generally no nuance on that. And that generally produces crap content.
You're about halfway into this week's episode of the Optimized Podcast, and I just want to let you know about our buyer journey product. It's a really cool one, and it just came out. It gives you insight into where users are traveling throughout your website. You can look at entry and exit flows. So for example, if you want to see all of the different pages that a user has traveled down by the time they've reached your Book a Demo page, you could do that. Or for example, if you want to see the pages that users go down or travel through after reaching your homepage, you can see that too. Positional's buyer journey product is meant to give you insights in terms of how users are engaging with your site and how they ultimately end up to their final destination. We'd love for you to check it out at positional.com. And now back to the rest of this week's episode. And as a follow-up, I saw on LinkedIn recently you wrote that Google should create a differentiation score. What do you mean by this and how would it work?
So like, I don't have this planned out. I need to like totally think this through because it does get complicated once you start thinking it through. But there should be, and I have a very, very hot take on this one. There should be some kind of different like originality score. And there are patents that do talk about originality that people think are perhaps embedded in the helpful content update, which they might be. Well, there is no more helpful content update. There's just the various signals Google has that are now integrated into the core algorithm. But who the hell knows what's actually there now? But there is no specific helpful content update. But people have thought this originality score thing is part of the helpful content update. If it's there, it's not working. Fundamentally, there needs to be some kind of incentive to tell content producers that they have to be original. Because what it really all comes down to is incentive cycles. Imagine like PageRank back in the day. PageRank back in the day indicated to content creators that we need to reach X threshold of quality or Google won't rank us, right? We need to have whatever X level of quality that would be. We need to have that. Panda came out, that threshold went up. But all content creators did was say, okay, now I need to reach that threshold to hit Panda level thresholds. So the level of quality that web content producers produce is in line with the technology that Google has available to it in order to parse out quality versus not quality. And that's the incentive cycle. That's why if you had Google saying, hey, you know what? Imagine like one day you woke up and Google all of a sudden invented a brand new technology, an AI or whatever, that automatically like increased quality parsing by 20,000,000%. Nothing would rank anymore. Everything would be completely different. And content producers would all of a sudden be freaking out. Red alert. We now have to up our game to do X, Y, and Z in order to align with this new quality threshold. The issue is that Google's very incremental because technology development is very incremental. So in 2018, Google starts rolling out the new wave of core updates and the threshold increases a little bit as SEOs start talking about, wait a second, we're starting to notice something very, very different in the algorithm. And I think that's where SEOs have so much power over the web. When Lily Ray and Glenn Gabe and Dr. Pete from Moz and Marie Haynes all start talking about, oh, Google's doing this, everybody else starts seeing that. And everybody else starts talking about the level of content we need, the level of quality content we need to produce has upped, you know, just a bit. But that lags a little bit behind what Google's actually doing, but it's very, very incremental. So over the last number of years that these things are happening, you start to slowly see content producers shifting a little bit towards improving their content quality. That's not a very good incentive at this point for content producers to say, you know what, we need to like completely rethink how we're going about content. So Google needs a game changer at this point. But what's happening with Google is that people are outpacing the algorithm. People are, when I say people, like I mean like readers, audience, consumers, users, as we call them. In my mind, a user like my parents are users. They're like leeches. That's a user. People are not users. They don't manipulate things. People just consume things. So let's call them consumers as opposed to users. People who are consuming things have outpaced the algorithm. They're looking at it like, wow, this is crap. They're looking at like, you know, you see like the New Yorker put out an article and Wired put out an article and The Verge puts out an article saying like the web results are worse than they used to be. That's not true. The Google results are way better than they used to be. However, our expectations of them has all of a sudden jumped to what we expect from consuming web content. And Google needs some kind of game changer to say, hey, wait a second, you need to change the whole way you're thinking about content. And in order to do that, they need to create some kind of game changer that now incentivizes all of us who are creating content to do something completely different. And to me, that's something like a real hardcore originality score, where Google's basically penalizing you for putting out the same crap that somebody else did, but with a little bit of a twist. Like, that needs to go away. The problem is that how do you actually do something like that? And also, if you do something like that, well, you kind of need to balance that. You do need to have X, Y, and Z fundamentals included in that content. So how do you really differentiate? And then how do you show all of that differentiation on the SERP? Because now, as opposed to having 10 articles that talk about the topic from one point of view, you have one article that talks from one point of view, another from another point of view, another from another point of view. That's many, many, perhaps many, many different intents all on one SERP. The SERP can't handle that, and it can't. So Google would have to reshape what the SERP actually looks like, which I think fundamentally is part of the main issue, is that the SERP still is based on 10 blue links, but 10 blue links don't work anymore. So yes, you need an originality score of some kind. It would be completely disruptive. You may not want to go with that long term, but I think you would want to do something like that, even if it meant, and this is a really hot take, even if it meant the same, you know, like the typical results that rank for whatever queries, if they stayed the same for 6 months, meaning you couldn't just copy what they're doing, try to replicate it and break into that market, because nothing is moving. Those rankings are locked in. Head terms, imagine a world where all head terms, the rankings, the top five, top 10 rankings are locked in for 6 months. Nothing's moving. You're forced to go longer query. That would be insane, but it would work.
Well, as far as originality goes, and you know, over the last, like, let's say 5 or 6 or 7 years, there's been so many like content optimization tools that have come to market where like they'll tell you the word count, they'll tell you which keywords to use, things like that. And I do think that has led to like a lot of websites largely publishing like the same cookie cutter articles as to what is already ranking. I think in like the your money, your life space, like if we're ranking for a keyword like heart disease symptoms, like Google wouldn't want to show like anything new or original, would they? Like that would be like risky.
No, that's what I mean. That's why, like, for that query, I would advocate lock in the rankings. You have the Mayo Clinic, Harvard Health, the Cleveland Clinic, WebMD, whatever it is, lock it in. Don't even let me try to rank for that for a while. Tell web creators, move the freak on to something else. The same thing for, like, I don't know, like, what's a tire? Do we really need more people trying to write what is a tire?
Probably not. Probably not. I do have just like one quick follow up. So if the new bar is like, you know, original content that offers unique takes and perspectives and sourcing, it sounds like we're really just trying to act like journalists. Like that is their job, to go out and collect original takes and sources and have a unique perspective.
Well, yeah. Or you're just an expert in your field.
And so I guess my question is, does like the cost of content increase dramatically as a result of this, like given that we're going to need to spend a lot more time to create these pieces?
Well, yeah, you would. Okay, yeah, if you're a content marketing agency, this is bad news for you, right? I'm not saying all content marketing agencies, I'm saying some content marketing. This is bad news because you just want to be able to go out there, do a little bit of research on Google, replicate, and spit it out there. If you're a business owner, this is great news, right? Because I am you're telling me, like, you know, like, what's the difference between X, Y, and Z and whatever, something a little bit more in depth. I can do that in 5 seconds. I'm an actual expert on this. This is great.
I have just an anecdotal example, and like our rankings might change, but I actually wrote an article about guest blogging, which is now on the first page of guest blogging. And like our website has like 30 backlinks. Like we should not be ranking on the first page of guest blogging, but we're ranking above some really big sites for that keyword. And with that piece of content, I tried to tell like a personal story. Like I walked you through like my experiences of guest posting. I showed you actual examples of guest posts that I've done across different types of websites. Like I wanted the user to feel like they were having a conversation with Nate. And I don't know if that's why this post is ranking on the first page, but I think it kind of aligns to your point. Like I'm using my unique experience. I've written hundreds of guest posts. I could have written like what was a very cookie cutter 1500 word article about guest blogging, but I didn't do that.
Was it harder for you or not really?
I would actually say it's easier. It's actually sometimes easier to just speak from your experience versus try to like fill in like a rigid like content outline.
Yeah, totally. I did the same thing with Barry Schwartz. If you look, search for who is Barry Schwartz SEO, because it's Barry Schwartz who's a psychologist. I built a whole website called BarrySEOMemes.com. And, you know, it fluctuates up and down, but I currently have two pages ranking on page one of the SERP. And I'm ranking above, you know, like search engine. I'm ranking above search engine. I'm ranking higher than his own bio on SEROundtable.com. Because I know Barry. I'm an expert on Barry. It's the greatest thing I've ever done, but there's no backlinks. Maybe now there's some. I don't even know. I do basically no SEO on this stupid thing. The homepage is like relatively garbage, but there's a lot of really good information. Like, is Barry Schwartz Catholic? No, he's not Catholic. He's Jewish. Is Barry Schwartz Eli Schwartz's cousin? No, he's not his cousin, even though they have the same last. But it was easy to write. There's actual expertise there about Barry because I'm an expert on Barry. No one knows Barry better than I know Barry. Even Barry himself clearly, based on the rankings.
I love your title tag. Barry Schwartz, his The Life and SEO Memes. I do want to talk about backlinks real quick because we're kind of on the subject. Like, how important are backlinks in 2024? More or less important than they used to be?
I hate this question, not because it's a bad question, but because like the way people parse this question or think about this question, like if it's like, I don't know, like some kind of like zero sum, they can be extremely important. They might be even more important, but in a certain context. I think the context is everything. Like if you're asking this question from like the traditional, like how important are backlinks? Way less important, because Google's better at understanding content and links are a secondary signal. So why rely on a secondary signal if I can rely on a more primary signal? That just logically doesn't make any sense. However, if you're looking at it from the point of view, like I'm a new website, let's say, and I'm trying to break into a market, and Google's basically trying to understand like, okay, like how valuable are you? Who are you? Like, what's the nature and worthwhileness of your digital existence? Links are a very big factor. Like links are, I look at links in the context of like your digital light and Google being a moth that's attracted after light. How big is your digital light? Links are a very important way. Social is a very important way for Google to gauge how big your digital light is. Your entity connections are a big way for Google to understand like what is the nature of your digital light and how bright are you? So links are very important, but not in the traditional kind of like, oh, I get a link and I increase the link juice and now I'm ranking better.
Speaking of like that halo effect signal, and we've talked a little bit about like expertise on this podcast so far, I want to talk about EEAT a little bit. And you've written some wonderful LinkedIn posts on the subject of EEAT. So first, for all of our listeners who might just be like a little bit early or in their SEO journeys, what is EEAT?
So Google has a thing called the Quality Rater Guidelines, which are basically people who manually review websites and assign scores. And the scoring is based on these guidelines so that it's not arbitrary. And in these guidelines, Google talks about evaluating a web page or a website based on experience, expertise, authoritativeness, and trustworthiness. Now, what happened was, historically speaking, going back to the Medic update in August 2018, SEO started noticing that a lot of the things that Google was doing algorithmically kind of aligned to what Google was talking about in the Quality Rater Guidelines related to EEAT, or at the time it was EAT. There was no experience in the EEAT-ness. And ever since then, it's been this whole big debate between SEOs like, I will fight you on this. EEAT is part of the algorithm, it's not part of the algorithm. SEOs will split all sorts of hairs on what the hell that means. Google is basically kind of come out and saying there is no EEAT score, but we try to simulate how a user would look at quality algorithmically through multiple systems and multiple factors. So like net result, like I don't see any damn difference. Like Google's always trying to simulate how a user would actually understand the website from a quality point of view, because Google's trying to align quality what users expect. So EAT in my mind is basically a North Star to help you align with how Google might be trying to think about its definition of quality, how it defines quality, so that you can perhaps also align as well, which fundamentally aligns with what users want.
And this is a hot take question. How important are authors when it comes to EEAT? Like, do they matter or does it not matter?
Ah, man. Yeah, okay. I think it does matter. But the question is, like, in what context does it matter? Okay, so where do I start with this? I think the biggest problem with EEAT is that SEOs, and SEOs are not unique this way, people don't think conceptually. People just think like, all right, like, give me something very linear, very concrete that I can rely on and just do my thing. But fundamentally, life is very conceptual. There's no way around having a more conceptual framework and a conceptual outlook on things if you really want to be able to thrive in an ecosystem. In this case, I think if you look at EAT very conceptually, author bios kind of do factor in. If you're looking at EAT as like a checklist, like, oh, I need to have an author bio, And I better add reviewed by somebody with a bunch of letters after their name. That's stupid. That doesn't matter. If you're looking at it as a concept and you're trying to say, okay, like I'm trying to create a more transparent web page or a more transparent user experience, then how Google holistically looks at a web page, that might factor in. Is Google looking at it as, oh, author bio? Check, great, increase ranking. Is Google perhaps trying to simulate the user's desire for transparency on the web page? So that would include things like a published date, not just an author bio, but a published date. Was it written by AI content? If it was written by AI content, was it reviewed by a human? All of those sort of transparency elements, does that somehow factor in a holistic kind of way? Perhaps, yes. In the Quality Reader guidelines, Google said if a web page or a website rather says, we have AI written content, but they don't specify which pages. That's a very low quality experience. So you see, Google is trying to find a way to look and make sure that a website is being transparent. And what it can do algorithmically yet around that, I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows. But clearly Google's trying to head in that direction. So why wouldn't you steer that way? And in any regard, your users expect that. Users want that. So why not do that? And I'll give you just one last point on the transparency aspect. And this I have seen algorithmically. There is a website, there probably still is a website called draxe.com. That's everyone's favorite.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We had Rebecca Edwards on. She was one of our earliest guests. She hasn't been at Dr. Axe in a long time, but she had spent some time there.
You found the SEO from Dr. Axe?
One of them, yes.
Oh, that's awesome. I got to listen to that because that's like that was the first website when I would look at the 2018 Medic update. That was the classic example of getting hit. And everyone's used that example. Can I interview you now? What did she say about what happened there?
You know, Rebecca was one of our earliest guests, so I'm having to think back.
Yes, I don't want to put you on the spot.
I'll try to like paraphrase what I remember. She described that I think the content on the site got like way too broad. They spread themselves way too thin across like a very large number of topic categories that they shouldn't have been in, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think her point was that even with the update that had happened at that time, like it wasn't the entire website that was impacted. It was from like, you know, from a keyword tracking tool. Yes, it looks like the entire website was impacted. But under the surface, she made it seem like it was a little bit more granular in that, like, you know, some of their, you know, core pages, their core topic areas maybe weren't as negatively impacted as others. And so she kind of took that as a signal that like they spread themselves too thin across a whole large set of keywords and topics they shouldn't have actually been writing about.
That's interesting.
But, you know, from what I remember, they were the case in point example of like not EE, like, you know, like almost conspiracy in like the medical space.
Well, it kind of aligns with what she's saying, right? Like my take on that website was that they were they're a covert e-commerce site disguising itself as an informational site. And that profile, Google realized that profile because they weren't transparent about it. Because what they were doing was they were reaching out to all these like ancillary areas of the web or of health. They were trying to really aggressively push you to the magical powders and potions that they're selling and courses that they're selling. So they would have like an ad like, you know, like, is kale healthy for you? They would have like a banner ad, another banner ad, another banner ad, a side ad, whatever it was. Like, and that's just the first fold. And then a pop-up ad. And then you scroll down. All of the links in between were pushing you to like take their course on how to be a healthier human.
Or buy their supplements.
Or buy their supplement, whatever the hell it was. And that's a case of you not being transparent with who you actually are. But you're not actually a health information site. You're a health commerce site.
Right.
So be transparent. If they would have been more transparent about and separated the two out a little bit, I think they would have been fine. That's a case of Google is going after transparency. To circle back to author bios and all that kind of stuff, you see Google does have an algorithmic ability to kind of parse out transparency to whatever extent. So you should be as transparent as possible.
And we see that with, you know, sites like NerdWallet, where they've got, you know, of course, they're getting paid by the different banks and financial services firms they work with. But like the editorial reviews and like the ratings in which they assign certain companies are like independent of the compensation that they might getting or the lack thereof. And so you would hope that Google can recognize and see the transparency. I think they do try to make it very clear for users.
Exactly.
But I agree with you that Dr. Axe was like a whole mess of not transparency and maybe even misleading at times.
I mean, do you think like, I don't know, like CNN, okay, if CNN had all of their articles written by staff, you think Google wouldn't notice that? And if they didn't notice that, like, forget EEAT, the whole web is screwed.
You know, and I could be getting this wrong, but to play devil's advocate, doesn't like the Associated Press publish all of their articles under staff?
Yeah, so the AP is different and the AP is weird. And the AP, I think, is interesting. If I remember this, looking at this years ago at this point, I don't think the AP even like self-canonicalizes. Like, I think they know they're going to be syndicated and they're not even looking to rank to a certain extent.
Well, maybe they don't need to because they make all their money from like the Newswire service.
They make, yes, they're all in on the syndication. So like they're just, so I don't think they care. I would venture to say, I think Reuters is a little bit different. I think Reuters does try to grab a web presence, like a organic web presence. But I don't think the AP is looking to like, they're like, yeah, we're just selling the content. Like, what do we care?
I have just one follow-up on EE. There are a lot of theories out there. Can you tell us what's the biggest misconception about EEAT?
I think the biggest misconception about EEAT is that they're all, these are four different concepts. It's all one concept. It's all like, I quote the story all the time. There was a Neil Young concert and some bozo's at the, you know, sitting in the front row and screams out, "All your songs sound the same." And Neil Young goes, "It's all one song."
That's great.
They're not different concepts. They're all the same. They're all an overlap. They're all the same concept. I kind of think they all lead to trust, right? If I have experience in something, the experience per se is worthless. If you ask me, "Hey, Morty, you went to Disneyland. How was it?" I wrote back, "It was fun." Does my experience help you?
I do want to give Rolling Stone some credit here. They are on the first page for Neil Young. So they've nailed that one.
I feel like their classic rock game is just so strong, even though they've been pivoting away from that for years. And I haven't read Rolling Stone since they had physical magazines, but what do I know?
But Morty, this has been so much fun. If it's okay with you, I've got like a few lightning round questions I'd love to ask you.
Let's do it.
What is one thing that as SEOs we spend time on that is just a total waste of time?
Meta descriptions.
Google and Reddit recently announced a partnership deal. Do you have like a quick take?
That's a mess. I think training LLMs on Reddit is inherently a mess.
I know that refining brand messaging is one of your favorite things. How does one think about brand messaging?
Self-identity and understanding the overlap between your identity and the consumer's identity, but like know thyself on the existential level as a brand.
On Twitter, you highlighted that Google doesn't want you to have factual inaccuracies within your content. You note that the Boston Red Sox should replace all references to them being a baseball team and replace it with a hot pile of trash. I get that you're kidding, but how good do you think Google is at identifying factual inaccuracies within content?
Not too bad, not too great, somewhere in between. Yeah, I think that one problem with consensus is that you can have a consensus that's wrong all the time, like the Boston Red Sox are a baseball team. I think we'd all have a consensus to that, but in reality, there are hot pieces of trash.
Well, Morty, thank you so much for coming on the Optimized Podcast. We're going to link out to the Wix site, of course, so you've built at least one backlink today. We'll also link over to Barry's site. That might be an important backlink for him or for you for that site.
Yeah, please, if you could. Yes, thank you.
And then we'll also link to your LinkedIn and Twitter. And if you're not already following Morty, you should be. So go and do that. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to our listeners?
No, thank you for tolerating me for the last 40 minutes.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Optimize Podcast. If you're interested in signing up for Positional, head on over to positional.com. I think you're really going to get a kick out of what we've built. We've got tools for keyword research, tools for internal linking, tools for content analytics, and a heck of a lot more. We'd love for you to join at positional.com.